Roland Perry, welcome to Booktopia. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Caroline. It's been a while.
Congratulations on Celeste. I'm suffering a little bit from biography envy, I have to admit. How on earth did you come across this story?
Yes, well, I would not normally charge around looking for a female from that era. I knew about the courtesans, but when a chap like Tim Burstall, the filmmaker, now the late Tim, who was one of the most brilliant literary individuals I knew in this country, should have been a book writer rather than a filmmaker, threw me a one-pager and said, we can't get this up as a television series at the moment, or a film, we're talking 1990, would you like to do a biography of it, have a crack? And so I wrote an eight-page summary. I got very intrigued with her and the era. Again, it was through Tim. Coming from Tim, I thought it has to be something special in it. So it had everything, as you well know, Caroline, from the book. But I was fascinated first, in a bland sort of way, between the contrast of the Wild West of Australia and the Romantic period in France, which is a nice title for it, but it was just as wild as Melbourne. It just wasn't as beautiful in Melbourne as it was in Paris, where Celeste was born up.
Just let me interrupt you there, that we should, that the story starts in Paris and has a sort of unlikely twist and conclusion in bringing your subject, Celeste, to Melbourne.
Correct.
So, sorry to cut in on you there.
No, but, I was wandering around
You did make the point there that you weren't in the habit of sort of looking around for kind of female subjects, and I do think of you as a writer with a very masculine body of work, where you've looked at spies, and you've looked at cricket,
and war.
Mm-hmm. And so...
That's not Steve Waugh, but I did do his biography as well.
What was it about Celeste's story when Tim handed it to you that made you think that you would like to investigate a female story, a female sensibility, and a very feminine world?
Well, the first thing was Tim throwing it at me, and the second thing was this massive contrast between the two worlds of Australia and France at the time. We're talking about the mid of the 19th century. And the final thing, as I got into it, apart from the character, she became very interesting on many levels. Apart from that, she had a writer's life, and a really tough writer's life. I mean, here she had one of the most, if not the most powerful family in France. I mean, they were in line for taking over Monaco at one point in the 19th century. They were very big. It was a toss-up whether they'd fight for that or not.
That's not her.
That's the Chabrolins.
That's her
lover. That's her future husband's family. And they tried to crush her at every point. And I'm sitting on this property, as I call it, book property or book story, for a long time, and I'm dwelling on her fight as I'm actually writing books myself, not having the struggle that she had. There's always problems, of course, and your ego says, I want to invest in this book, and the publisher says, we're not interested, blah, blah, blah. This goes on all the time, as you know. And I'm very much, I don't take commissions. I've taken two of my 30 books, so I'm really wanting to get my stories out there, and it mightn't be a publisher's agenda. So I'm looking at her, who's had a similar approach, but she had the world against her. I only had a few odd people that didn't agree. She had everyone against. She was a woman trying to make it in a man's world. She had a family trying to crush her. They were part of the elite in France, and they could talk to the top publishers who were all part of the elite. It's not as it is now, where you can come from anywhere if you've got the will to publish. And they were trying to get rid of her because she had married into the establishment.
But even before we get to her being married to an aristocrat and his family thinking that she's, you know, absolutely toxic and going to drain their fortunes, let's start with her origins. Let's start with the fact that she becomes famous in the dance halls of Paris. And let's talk about the status of a courtesan. Tell us the beginning of the story where Celeste chooses the life of a prostitute, yes, and what it meant to register as Paris.
That's fundamental, going back to that. This is all part of the toughness of her life. So you're asking me what attracted. Once you start to do the research, you think, my God, she had it tough. From the beginning, the first stepfather, named Guy, all right, he's beating up the mother, her mother, and Victoire. He's beating her up regularly in front of the daughter. So they're terrified of him. Hasn't molested the child. The child is only eight at this stage. They skip it to Lyon. They leave him, Lyon. And he follows them there. And eventually he gets eliminated. We won't go into the story. And they go back to Paris. And then the next chap in line is Vincent. And Vincent is a predator of her when she begins to develop. She was mature for her age, you know, she had developed at 13, like a 16, 17-year-old, he would come home drunk and he'd molest her, and she was very upset with this. She was in love with him at first, thinking his attention was all at her, but it was in fact her mother. And when they found out, when she found out the mother was his attention, she became spiteful towards him, didn't actually exonerate him from some pretty rough treatment. And he tried to rape her at one point, she ran away. Now she ends up in the street, cutting it short really, with a prostitute who very kindly, a young prostitute, takes her under her wing when she knew that if she was caught with a minor, that she'd be in trouble, big trouble, because that's corrupting a minor.
Right.
That's universal almost in the Western world. Anyway, she, they are caught by the police. The kindly cop says, you can get off, Madame Prostitute or Mademoiselle Prostitute, but Celeste, you've got to go down to the police station and you're going to end up in jail. So she ends up in a sort of a prison stroke halfway prison for women like her who actually have not committed a felony of any kind. She ends up in a prison and it's got some really hardened females in it. And there she's taken under her wing by a 16-year-old named Denise. That was her stage name, if you like. And she is bisexual and tough, and she seduces her. Now, it was interesting to see the memoirs because she was clearly heterosexual all the way through, but confused. She had affection and love, didn't really get much from the mother. The mother was caring but wasn't affectionate, and made the choice between the nasty, groping stepfather and her, made the choice for the stepfather, the partner. And here was a woman showing affection and love, and they were having a relationship in the prison, which was common, by the way, in Saint-Lazare prison, and is still everywhere, possibly. And so she tells her about, once you leave prison, come with me to a magnificent brothel. She paints a wonderful picture of the people she's going to meet. Now, this kid, this is Celeste herself, fantasizes over meeting an aristocrat and marrying from the word go, because she's seen them on the boulevards where she lives, in the theatres. She loves the theatre, and she sneaks along to the matinees and she sees the sort of people in the theatre, and they've got their top hats and their dandies with their wonderful women and all the rest of it. And she's rather turned on. And after having that terrible working class experience with these two rough guys in her life, she's looking to climb over all that. That's her fantasy without the experience. She's got enormous naivety about what happens in life. So she ends up, after she can't stand going back home, Vincent's still the predator, she then says, right, I'll go to the brothel, and she goes to the brothel. And then, come back to your question about registering, she has to register as a prostitute, which is a pretty hideous business, because getting it off it really means the very best in the land, the highest of the elite in the land, have to help exonerate you and get you off that register. It's with you for life. You're a prostitute for life in the eyes of the court and the police and everyone else. And you're harassed and harried for the rest of your life. If you commit a minor misdemeanor, you could come back to prison once you've been caught as a prostitute outside that system.
One of the things that makes that period, though, so interesting is the sort of elevated status of certain prostitutes that we call courtesans. And let's face it, courtesan is a grand name for someone who is still
a high-class prostitute.
A high-class prostitute sex worker. So these courtesans spent a tremendous amount of money, lived a very opulent life, had incredible power and influence through the men who were their lovers.
Correct.
So tell us a little bit about the world of the courtesan and the status of the courtesan in Parisian life at that time, because it is a unique period, isn't it?
It is. Well, there are several levels of prostitution, street prostitute and brothel. The Gisette, who is the middle prostitute, then there's the courtesan, the high class, who are on a par with the actresses of the day, which was post-revolutionary France. There was it was a liberated period where the aristocracy was mixing with the artists from the working class and so forth, which included actresses and courtesans. So that was Paris and France at the time. Now, she had, you mentioned the dance start that she had by being a superstar. Well, not quite a superstar. Let's say a star in Paris at the dance halls, the open air dance halls. And she was the best dancer of all of them, and they knew it. And she I've traced it back. I'm not as certain as the Carmen connection, but I'm certain that she was well in there as creating the precursor to the can-can.
The can-can, yeah.
Because she was the first one to lift the skirt and really make the polka sexy. It
was. So she kind of did an extra high kick,
that's
you're
right,
saying.
That's right. And she had the body, she had the legs, she looked terrific, and she was a great dancer, and she learnt very fast. She was a natural.
And you suggest that later on she may or may not have been the inspiration for Bizet's Carmen.
Oh, no, which... I'd say she was. No question in my mind about it. All the historical elements. A lot of historians have said it. I'm not the first one.
Wow.
They just haven't drawn the narrative about her connection. No, I have no doubt. The can-can is, it's 60 years earlier that she began lifting the dress, but no one else was doing it with the high kicking.
And she takes on a stage name, doesn't she? She becomes Mogador.
Mogador, yeah, that's her partner, Brigidi, who is a male dancer partner, who selects her, gives her the name Mogador, because the French had been firing on the town Mogador at the time. They often did this sort of silly connection, and she was known as Mogador.
And then, what I find so fascinating about her is not only is she kind of a free spirit and an extrovert, and she...
Post-brothel for the listeners. This is when she's 17, 18 now. So she's got out of the brothel.
Terribly young.
Yeah, she's very young.
She then, with that fame from the dance halls, moves into another kind of performance where she exhibits tremendous
courage.
Physical courage.
Well,
tell us about the chariot. Well, the current
Ben-Hur movie, it would be a sandpit with children in it compared to what she went through.
Yeah.
They treated them like dirt and animals. That's the promoters and managers of this outdoor theatre called
the
Hippodrome.
So this was like a kind of circus, wasn't it?
It was an outdoor circus called the Hippodrome. And the elite went along, everyone went along, there were sort of 8,000 to 10,000 in the audience watching these great chariot races. And she was one of the, she was the best, she was the winner, and nearly killed herself in that. Now, you're moving from stardom in the Paris environment to superstardom. At the same time, she's still playing around with this courtesan act, but suddenly she's so famous, they all want to bed her, they all want to be the paramour, all this is the elite, and anyone who's got any breeding or background or education wants this woman. She's one of the very few at this point, along with the actresses, and she becomes known virtually as Mademoiselle Knob, because she can choose. Now, this is the fame thing that's given her this incredible public image suddenly. And she's loving it. She's built for this.
So this is real notoriety.
Yes.
I mean, we would call it celebrity
today.
Well,
it's fame rather than notoriety, I think,
do
at
you?
This stage. Yeah, because she was. It's like, you know, suddenly she's Buddy Franklin.
Right.
You know, she's a superstar in Paris. And the courtesan bit is just a part of the elements of her image. But the main thing now is that everyone goes to watch her, and she's still stunning, of course, at that
age.
Is
she rich, then? Is she making money?
She's making money, but not... She still wants to settle with the very best man she can. But at that stage, it's money-driven, because she has a very anti-male position, naturally, from her experiences with the stepfathers. Then the fantasy of the upper-class person going to the brothel is disrupted and corrupted by the fact that they treat her... they abuse her verbally. And she's not used to that, so she's meeting people like Alfred de Musset, the great poet, who is a misogynist at this point. He's been rejected by George Sand, and he's very upset, so he goes to the brothel and abuses females there, verbally, not physically necessarily, but verbally. So she's got this vision of males, and she's virtually saying, well, stuff them all, I'm going to get as much money as I can. She hasn't fallen in love, she's sort of fallen in love with one doctor.
Yes.
But then he's got a mistress on the side, so this adds to her fuel or her mentality on males, per se.
And in fact, when she falls in love with the aristocrat Chabillon, he's a complete spendthrift. He's absolutely hopeless at managing his property. He's losing his property daily. So he's completely inept
role. He's not a dandy, and most of the crowd she was meeting in the best cafes were dandies. They were foppish. They were very proud of the fact they'd never worked. They only had inherited
he's
money.
He's older, isn't he?
He's no, he's not much
older.
He's mid-20s.
Oh,
no, he's only 4 or 5 years older
than
her. At this stage, she's moved into her 20s, and they meet at the Café Anglaise, and he steps in. I don't think we need to tell them that, but he does a very gallant thing in protecting her from people who are abusing her, which was part of the sport of being picked up. You had to take abuse from these ne'er-do-wells, and then they might take you home and look after you for a week or a month or whatever.
It's such a sort of hand-to-mouth, piecemeal existence, isn't it?
No, it is. It's a chancy existence. It's a very chancy. It's just like being a writer or an actress, really.
Well, I don't want to tell the whole story because I think we should leave the reader to discover the incredible dramas and tantalising sort of vicissitudes and rollercoaster ride of her life. But what interests me is the approach that you've taken in the book, which is sort of unconventional in a way, in that it's not a straightforward biography as a historical biography might be. You invent dialogue.
No.
What are you doing with the conversations
Let's go back.
In the book? Well, are they taken from her memoirs?
Her memoirs are a gift.
Right.
The difference is, if you're an academic approaching it, you don't know how to do a biography or a narrative, you're not thinking into a big audience, you just translate the memoirs.
Right.
But I'm looking at it, when I first got that book, I was not equipped. 16 biographies on, I was equipped to look at how you develop a narrative. And the letters and the memoirs give you more than you need. I had to pull her back at certain points. The drama was incredible. There was one point where they're having a physical fight, and you think they're both dead by the end of the description, and
so
she walks away.
She was a bit of an exaggerator, Roland.
Oh, was she?
Yes.
This is where your maturity and judgment, good or bad, comes in. And
right.
At my certain age, I've got a good judge on people, I think. I've got a good beat on character. It's a natural thing, and I'm doing it in my work. And I was looking for the lack of integrity. And I found only on a couple of occasions did she go over the top, and I found her out exaggerating badly on a couple of occasions. But really, the stuff I was able to check was 100% right. And her humility and humour and character came through all the time in the memoirs.
So you're telling me that the dialogue in the book is not by you. The dialogue comes from her.
Absolutely. And her letters, where she's in discourse with someone, I've sometimes truncated that into a dialogue.
Of course.
But generally I use the letters as they are when I've used letters. No, it's a gift. For someone experienced in biography, it would be tough calculating in your head. Don't forget, I've sat with this story for a quarter of a century. So I've gone back, I've read.
You sat with it for a quarter
of a century? Well, 1990, it was thrown to me by Burstall, so I'm able to read as much as I can about the era, about her. I even struggled, keen word, with The Gold Thieves, her greatest book, best-selling book, in French with a dictionary about 25 years ago. And there's been a translation, which was a bad one, I thought. And so I've been living with it, and my career's developed, and I've been watching her struggle. So she's been an inspiration, to be honest. I feel I know the woman very well. She'd be at my best dinner party of all time, along with Queen Victoria, John Monash and Don Bradman and a few others. But she is a sensational character, and I admired her pluck. I admired the fact that she took on everything and usually won.
Let's jump forward. So let's leave the reader kind of tantalised about the middle of the story, but why does she end up in Australia? Yeah. I mean, she's kind of scandalised French society, and then she kind of...
Because she had her memoirs come out, remember, too. So she couldn't write, admits this, and her mentor, Alexandre Dumas Sr., Count of Monte Cristo...
If you're going to have a mentor, that's
yes.
the mentor to
well,
have.
Well, he was a lover first, and he admired her enormously in her pluck and decided to support her and guided her. And he said... We'll come to why she goes to Australia. But he would say, I think this is fascinating from my point of view, and I hope listeners and readers find the same thing. But he was saying, don't do fiction, non-fiction. You've done your non-fiction memoir. Open up, learn to write as a fiction writer. There's much more money in it, he said, and there are plays to come and all sorts of things. And she listened to him. He was a great character. He was the best-selling author in the world at that
yes,
point.
Yes, he was.
And she's saying, well, what do you want me to do? He said, when you go to Australia, whenever you put up the sign of the cross, I'm not going to touch that, it's too difficult or it's too ugly, that's what you write. And it's a great lesson. I've always gone by that myself.
What do you mean, the sign of the cross?
Well, the sign of the cross is, you know, you can't go there.
Right.
If someone puts the sign of the cross up, you're not supposed to go there.
Right.
That stops you. The demons are on the other side of it, you don't go there. And she listened to this and did things in Australia she never would have done. She went to a public hanging. The whole point revolted her, but she gives the most brilliant description of the man being hanged, and it's a shocking thing to read when you read it. But I thought, looking at it, I put the professional hat in, I think she did a really good job in describing
that. So she had a kind of journalistic eye.
She had a very good writer's eye. I wouldn't even say journalistic. Mm. I'd say a writer's eye for the atmosphere. You know, she'd had a Hemingway-esque sort of mentality in a way. And she took that on board with all her writing, and The Gold Thieves to me, is the best book written by a Farang, written by a foreigner from Australia. Well, I'm including D.H. Lawrence, who wrote Kangaroo.
That's quite a claim you're making there.
Yeah, well, that is his worst book.
So it is his worst book, and, I know.
And then you're looking at Mark Twain in 1895. Non-fiction, interesting, but not that great. And then you've got to go up to Bill Bryson with his look at
so
our country.
Where is this book of hers?
Well, it's I think it was translated here. I've never seen it anywhere and hard to get. 40 years ago, perhaps, and it needs a rebirth because it is a good. It is a, what it is. It's more than a snapshot of the two eras, of the two, particularly Australia, of course, because she's talking about Australia, and she uses all the experience. I mean, there's wonderful drama in coming from on the boat trip, which is the, you know, the murderous thing. Anyone who comes to this country from anywhere, even up until now, think of the Vietnamese in the last 40 years, and now Afghans and everyone coming. It's horrific. It's dangerous. It's tough. And if you write about it, it's enthralling. Everyone who comes here, even on a plane from England, you know, you're still an exciting thing, Caroline. And so she captures all that, the boat trip, what it was like here. She has the writer's eye. She's been instructed by the best on how to do it. And she develops as a writer. The funny thing is, I've got to go back to Chabrolet, the Count, because he is, as you rightly say, is a pretty obnoxious character.
He's just a bit hopeless.
But he's got a lot going. He's the youngest son in this family, or the youngest member of the family. And he leaves France to go to the furthest end of the world. That's Australia. They thought he'd go to South Africa, Australia, somewhere, you know, the Antarctic. Can I go there?
Wherever.
He goes to Australia because of the gold rush. But he's really trying to get away from the stultifying atmosphere, and he cannot marry this woman. Mm. He's run through his inheritance. The family is saying, now, okay, you marry a countess who's got a purse and got money and inheritance, and you have to keep up the level if you want to do it. He's stymied by that, and he's desperately in love with this woman, this courtesan. She loves him, but being the shrewder, smarter, street smarter one, she knows it's not going to happen because he cannot break from that upper class
tradition, you know,
the aristocracy. Mm. Cannot break from it. And the family hate her guts because if she married him, she becomes a countess. Fancy having a working class hooker who might, in fact...
Pretty woman gone mad.
It is, and it's real. That's what's great. I loved it. It was real. I don't think there's a better love story in the last 200 years. I really do not. And I haven't read every love story, but boy, this has got everything. And so he hightails it out to Bathurst in New South Wales. As a miner, he doesn't try and get anything, you know, highfalutin. He decides to be a miner. For a bloke who's never lifted a spade or done anything, you know, he comes out here and is broken physically when he returns. Mm. But after 18 months, 2 years in Australia, he is a man. He's come back tough. He can't put any graces out in the outback. He can't do it. He has to dig with the miners. Fails to earn his fortune, comes back, but he has gained a lot of courage. He's found himself. He goes straight back. He says, I'm going to marry you. Goes to the family. He doesn't tell them he's going to marry her. He says, I want to be consul in Australia. And they can pull strings and they get in. And they don't. They think, oh, good, he's going to get away from the Scarlet Woman.
Little do they realise.
And then as soon as he's done that, and this is the best part of the book from his perspective, shows his character's developed, he takes her to England and marries her three times.
Not just once.
I know. It's wonderful. 10, 11 and 12 in the morning. 10 o'clock he goes to the registry office. 11 o'clock he goes to the church. She prostrates herself in front of the priest because the terrible Catholic guilt that weighed on everyone even up until the last 30 or 40 years, massive Catholic guilt, as a prostitute, for God's sake, marrying into the aristocracy, and she's a blubbering wreck. She doesn't know he's paid off the priest anyway to be kind to her and absolve her of all the past. Yes, and so they finally get married a third time in front of, this is the most cunning and shrewd and brilliant bit of his actions towards her, in the French Chancery in London, which means it's notarized and noted in terms of France.
Which is great.
And she cannot then have the Countess, her title taken away from her by anyone.
So they have the last
laugh. So he worked that all out. He worked that all out. So he suddenly developed into a human being. And the other thing was, when he was in Melbourne as the consul, he was a terrific consul. He really worked hard and did not want to leave Australia at all, because he didn't. He stayed there.
This is what happens, Roland. You come here, you fall in love with the country. It's the making of you.
Yes, that's
true.
Look,
it's a rip-roaring story. It is an absolutely extraordinary story. I do recommend it to everybody, and I have to congratulate you again on Céleste.
I'm sorry you've got this envy. I never would have believed it, Caroline. But thank you very much for interviewing me.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.